You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
This is a panel on revisiting Naked on the Internet, which is my book that came out 2 years ago, actually according to Amazon, exactly 2 years ago today.
Wow.
And I was researching this book in the fall of 2006, and it came out in May, June of 2007. And all the people that I have here with me are women who I interviewed for the book. The book is specifically about women and sex and the internet. So I interviewed all women, some trans women also. But so we decided to sort of come together. This panel was formulated in comments on my blog, as all good panels seem to be. So basically I want to start with all of us doing like little personal updates of what's happened for us in the past 2 years, what's changed, what's stayed the same, and then we have a list of an agenda item that's on my iPhone, and so we'll go through all that. So I'll start out. So like I said, the book came out in 2007. Since then, I've done a bunch of different stuff. I guess the big thing that's been marked for my last 2 years is the process of kind of going legit. I now have a full-time nonprofit job. I'm working at the International Women's Health Coalition in New York as an online strategist. So I do online strategy for sexual health and rights. I run a blog for IWC that's called Akimbo. That I have little bookmarks, actually, I'll pass around if you want to take those home with you and go check it out. And I'm also teaching human sexuality at Rutgers University. So that's my super legit thing. And in all those jobs, I'm actually totally out. Rutgers knows that I used to be a hooker, and they know I made porn. And same thing for my day job, which is kind of fun. I'm gonna stop there. Amber?
Okay. I'm Amber. I don't have updates in terms of like my resume or anything like that, jobs, but I guess one thing that's changed is that I've become more involved in like activism online, getting more involved in communities online. I mean, I started my blog in 2002, but it was really about the time that Daisha interviewed me in fall of 2006 that I was getting more active in the feminist blogging community, and also starting to take a lot of those online interactions offline. Since that time, I've gone to tons and tons of conferences, organized two, PodCamp Atlanta and Sex 2.0 last year, because I think there's a lot more crossover that we're seeing between the online and the offline. It's not a separation anymore the way people used to think of, you know, you've got your online life and your offline life. They cross over a lot. So I guess my update would be I've been exploring that and trying to enhance it through little pieces of activism here and there.
See, I remember where I was when Daisha interviewed me for the book. I was like sitting on my friend's couch because I had just moved out of my apartment and ended a 4-year-long relationship and left a job and had like major life upheaval, which basically moved me from being a very anonymous, not totally anonymous, but more pseudonymous person online to using my name more and kind of putting myself out there as a full person and not just like blogging about private stuff. Like when I look back on the stuff I was making in 05 and 06, it seems very obscure, and it feels like I was worried about how much of myself to put out there in public. Like I didn't know if I was going to talk about really personal stuff, then I like shouldn't link it too much to my real world activities. And so I feel like I had a second coming out online in the intervening years. I started writing for a website in 2008 called Ballywag, which was a gossip site about Silicon Valley, and took back my legal last name, and so started, instead of being Melissa Gira, Melissa Gira Grant, which a lot of people ask me if I got married, and I'm like, isn't it obvious? Like, I'm not getting married. But apparently it wasn't, because that's what women, I guess that's the normal way for women to change their name, not to go from sex to their family name again. What else? My mother sent me a letter saying that she had looked on the Google and found out some things about me, and she was very concerned, but that she wanted to know that She wanted me to know that she loved me no matter what I was doing on the internet. And to this day, because I don't know what page of Google she saw when she wrote this letter, and I can't, there's no like Wayback Machine for like days of Google. I still don't know exactly what she saw. Did she see my Flickr? Did she see the new Twitter account I had that all of a sudden shot up in terms of their SEO being so good, taking on a huge part of who I am online? And I started working more as a writer and less like working as a writer for actual money and working in mainstream-ish publications and trying to push more in that direction and really valuing taking all of the good stuff that I got from writing mostly for sex positive and sex nerdy communities into a larger audience. And that seems to be more where I'm going. I'll stop there.
I'm Furry Girl. I unfortunately have had no major upheavals or accomplishments in my life in the last 2 years, but I guess still being around as an indie pornographer another 2 years later is a good thing because I've seen a ton of sites come and go. So that's all I've got for you.
Okay, and also feel free to ask us questions also because I don't want to just be us talking at you. Okay, so the first thing we were going to talk about a little bit is this idea of the person versus persona, which I think I'm going to make Melissa talk about more. Because she sort of gave a nod to that. But one of the things that I think has started to happen now, which she talked about also in the keynote this morning, is that there's this, because there's this rapid expansion of sex blogging online, and of course there's still a thing where people are cycling out really quickly, write a blog for 9 months, disappear, never to be heard from again. But there's also this thing that's happening where, you know, I've been keeping a blog for 5 years, Amber's, you just had your 7th anniversary of your blog, and so a lot of us are sticking around longer, and the relationship between this online identity is becoming less of a compressed thing and expanding into all pieces of our lives. And I think that that's something that's been really compelling for me in the past couple of years, and so I sort of wanted to open a little more discussion about that.
Do you want me to start?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm gonna make you do it.
I don't know. I mean, I'll do what I always do and just go from a really overly personal example. I started dating somebody basically from the internet, like this person who was somewhat well known in the San Francisco internet scene, and all of a sudden had to reckon with like the fact that by the time like he came over to my apartment for the first time, he's like, "Oh yeah, I saw pictures of your bed on Flickr." Like, I had to, like, reckon with the fact that, like, I had this life online that, like, I thought of as kind of part of maybe just this community. Like, I don't know why I would think that. I don't know why I would think that, like, only people of like mind or understanding would see what I was doing. But it was really strange to have people who, like, didn't necessarily share the intent with which I was talking about my sex life or even my whole life were bringing that back to me. And I had to realize, like, there is no division. You know, like, I may have not used my total legal name online, but I was still one singular body living in the world with one camera phone going everywhere I was going. Like, that was one person. And it took a process of kind of peeling away, like, who I was online versus who I was in person. Like, I never had to come out to him about being a sex worker. He just knew. And everyone I've dated since 2006 or 7 has just known, which is really strange. On the one hand, it's great not to have to come out around that, but on the other hand, the kind of person they think I am is so invested in like what they've read, what they've seen, what other people have talked about. Like, there is like kind of an anti coming out. But like, well, you think you know all these things about me. You think I tell my whole life to the internet, but you don't. Like, just because sex is seen as so personal, don't think you know everything about me. And so I've had to do some kind of overcompensating for that. Like, you know, feeling like some people think I'm so out there and realizing that's in the level of persona. And it's a reversal, I think, of how most people think of persona and real self. Like, I do have a private life, and one of the questions I kept getting asked by people as I went to tech conferences and kind of took a step more into that world was like, oh, but you put your whole life on the internet, so, like, you know, like, how do you even have a private life? But it's like, see, the thing is, you don't even think to ask about my private life. You already think you know everything, and that's what lets me have that private life. That's what lets this very big persona exist online, and I still have my own thing that I do. But, yeah, it's like realizing the ramifications of being so out. I'm still in it. I don't really know. It's making meeting new people kind of challenging. Thinking about all of this backlog of history they have access to. Just, you know, it's a real act of radical honesty. You just have to own up to everything that you've said when you've made yourself that indexable.
I think we're all kind of still in it, you know? I don't know if we'll ever really know perspective changes as more things happen, but the term I always hear is personal brand, which I hate. It really creeps me out, that term, actually. Like, I'm not a brand, I'm a person. Like, I don't know, it just really bothers me. And kind of like what you just said. I had somebody, this was a while ago, it's probably maybe even a couple years ago now. We were at like a happy hour or something with some local, like progressive political group people, and one of them said something jokingly like, haha, I feel like I know more about you than I know about some of my best friends. And it really got under my skin, because it's like something about when you write about sex, not even, because I don't even really write that much about like the mechanics of fucking and stuff, like just sexuality, certain topics, you know, when you write about those things, suddenly people for whatever reason assume that they do know it all, because obviously that's as far as you can go. That's as much as you would ever put out there. If you've taken that step, then you have no more boundaries. You've put it all out there. There's nothing else that people don't know. And I am very open on my blog online, but there are still things that, you know, I don't put out there. So I guess I always feel like sometimes I have to tell people, don't assume you know the whole story, because you know what I share, and I try to be very open and real and everything, but you don't know everything.
Sort of on that same topic, as a sex worker, I do porn sites, and the focus on my main one is the personal interaction angle and the I'm a real girl next door kind of thing. Real girl next door, of course, being in major air quotes. So I think Twitter changed a lot of the way that I compartmentalized with fans, because at first I wanted to make sure to not say too much about where I was or maybe at my offline world friends. And because of Twitter and because of that level of sharing, people were sort of saying like, oh, this is a link she's sending to some political thing, or this is something she's more opinionated about. And I've gotten better with sharing my real opinions with people through the Furry Girl interface with people who are customers, and I'm less afraid of scaring people off with my opinions. At first I was thinking, well, if they're Republicans and assholes, I want their money that much more, so I don't want to scare them away. But I've actually found a number of people, and I believe them when they say, I joined your site because I found you on Twitter, or I read that this thing that you said, and I think you're really smart and interesting, and of course I like to jerk off to you, but I found you through your opinions. So I'm sure it is scaring off some of the guys, but it's also drawing in more people who are interested in me as a sex worker who's opinionated. So the decompartmentalization, I don't know how well it cuts in each direction, but it's been an interesting little journey for me.
The Twitter thing I think is interesting because it's hit the other side too. Like I watched kind of the early adopters of the tech scene in San Francisco of Twitter, like these people who don't think of themselves as personal bloggers, right? They're like these kind of like A-list dudes of the internet who like make a living going to conferences and like spouting about how to use these tools, and watching them like talk about their kids and their pets and their families and like all these things in their personal life, and then doing it on Facebook. It's like all the stuff that we did that we've been told is frivolous or unimportant or weird, I'm watching like these kind of mainstream internet people do, and I'm loving it. It's like, good, you get to reckon with these questions too. Like all of a sudden now you're not just John Gruber daring fireball, you're John Gruber daring fireball whose wife Amy Jane is like way funnier than you on Twitter and has more followers. And, you know, like, it's really interesting to watch their personal and professional lives converge too, because they've always been in the same space we've been. It's just maybe they were like had some firmer walls up than we did.
Well, what we were doing was silly then.
Right.
Now they're doing it, so it's okay. But
yeah.
But like, you know, you were saying just a minute ago, Melissa, about, you know, people think they know you before they meet you in real life because they know your, you know, what your online presence is. And they get this idea of you. It's almost like the personal brand, like even if you don't want to create your personal brand, like other people are creating it and they have this idea of you, and that sometimes stresses me out. And I remember, Daisha, one time you were talking about, like, you know, somebody saying, oh, well, don't you go to all the crazy parties or whatever. You're like, I was at home that night ordering takeout. I mean, like, sometimes I do feel like as I've become, I guess, moderately internet famous or whatever, that people have this perception and it's really not real. And sometimes I feel like there's pressure to live up to that, and when in reality I'm just kind of awkward and just, you know, a real person.
I feel like I should blog more about changing the cat litter sometimes. I mean, I what is going to make me be an actual real girl?
But I feel like some of that is a function of creating digital intimacy, and that's one of the things that for me it has been powerful about Twitter and also other personal blogging platforms, whatever, is that idea that, oh, you don't know me, like, actually, they do. They know a different slice of you, and I think it's not fair to say that this persona is something that's separate, and that's something I hear a lot, especially with people in the sex blogging world, that it's like,
you know, oh, I created this persona and it's a separate entity than me. And I think that that's not really true, that these things are integrated. And even if you've created a character, it's still a piece of you, and you are still creating digital intimacy with other people, whether they're caricatures of who they are or not. I think that that's a really important thing, and that that idea of separation is kind of false. Like, even if you are pretending that you live elsewhere, or I don't know, that you're 50 pounds lighter than you are, or whatever, there's still some truth to
those. Well, I guess what I was saying was not about like creating another persona that you think of as not you, but that other people, because obviously that's all part of you. I hate compartmentalization. I don't really know how to do it, just so that's a big reason why I don't, because I don't think I could maintain it without fucking up and like posting to the wrong Twitter account or something. But that is part of, you know, what people know about me is part of me, but sometimes people assume that that's it and there is nothing more. And so that's kind of the distinction I was going for.
Are there any comments at this point before we move on to our next list on the iPhone?
Yeah.
The first person I met in real life was another blogger from, and it was really interesting talking to her, because she said, well, you know, and Fig Leaf says, she was talking to me. You know, but she, it was an incredible, because she really distinguished me from Fig Leaf. Like, she knew that I'm not, you know, I have a backspace
key. She knew that you were
Fig Leaf,
and
she heard
you in the
thing. Yeah, we were meeting, you know, and I knew she was who she was. But the thing is that because she'd been a blogger, maybe, she knew that I had a backspace key, too. And that I had 24 hours to think of my witty response before I posted and other stuff like that. So it was, in a way, now I have something to live up to. And that's actually changed me a bit. You know, because at home, I'm just a stay-at-home dad, where's supper? But, you know, when I'm, you know, but it turned out that I was, you know, what Dacia said, you know, there is integration. It's just not always, you know, sometimes your persona brings you along, too.
I was thinking about this like literally in the last week too, because I was having some angst about somebody in my life who I feel like over relies on the internet to attract sexual partners, because the real world is not that it's the real world, but it's somehow scary. And I was like, what's wrong with this person? Like, why is it so easy to Facebook stalk people to get them into bed, or like be witty on Twitter and get them into bed? And like, we're at our best in these mediums. Like, for writers, like, this is how you pick people up. You're smart and cute and clever, and like, you show your best face, and like, that's never seen as false in that kind of context. And yet what we're doing online is just showing off the parts of ourselves that maybe we wish we were more like, and creating a space where we can walk into them. And you know, I feel like I'm hoping in the next few years that these things start to fall away even more, this idea that like, we're fake on our blogs, or we're like only our best selves. It's like, well, that is still us, and it's just, you know, the face that we're showing the world at that given moment. And then, you know, some of us end up getting jobs for it, which then gets even stranger. Yeah, like, I had to become Melissa Jira at St. James Infirmary when I started working there, because that's part of the reason they hired me, is my blogging about sex work. And then all of a sudden I had to keep correcting everybody on payroll that I have a different name. And, I mean, I don't know, we grow into these things that we create. I think that should be okay.
How did you feel that being part of this book and having these personas maybe affected, I'm trying to look for a polite way to say this, but a lot of sex bloggers, I feel, get so lost in this persona and have this almost cockiness that they may or may not realize they have because they're so well known now, or they've been written about. Did you feel that that affected you at all, or people expected you to have that and then you didn't? I don't, did any of you, the group, I don't know, did that question kind of make sense? I just woke up from that, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not a sex blogger, so I don't know. I mean, I'm not a sex blogger, but I always get referred to as one because I hang out with so many of them.
Or as a giant, super awesome feminist blogger.
No, it's interesting to me. It's not like I'm saying, oh, I'm not a sex blogger, because I wouldn't want that label, that's the worst. But, you know, I blog about lots of different things, but once you blog about sex in any form, I think then, you know, it's like you're a sex blogger forever and ever. But so I don't know. I hope I'm not cocky.
I think
you guys find the proliferation of the internet and the larger general society acceptance of
Just acceptance of what?
Back in the 70s, for sure. My father was comptroller of the nation's largest adult distributor. We were persecuted. I mean, persecuted. And as just, I mean, they went after us with a vengeance.
Are you a Harvey?
I'm sorry?
Are you a Harvey?
No.
Oh. I thought you were talking about Phil Harvey.
What?
I thought maybe you were talking about Phil Harvey.
No, we were out of a Cleveland organization. It was a wholesale distributor. But anyway, I mean, this is the 70s. Now, with the proliferation of the internet, it's just so out there. And so, in everyone's homes, it's becoming more and more accepted. Do you see a larger degree of acceptance and that that's where things are going? Or do you see really people kind of pulling back and kind of bunkering in?
Acceptance of what? Of the technology or of sexuality
the
being...
sexual form for what's going on.
I don't think it's out there more in people's homes more. I think that's something we hear a lot. I think that's a line we hear a lot in the media. I don't think it's really true. I don't think because Girls Gone Wild commercials come on prime time. I mean, I don't perceive that as being the case. Maybe.
I mean, I also think, like, we might be bad people to ask because we're not the average user. And,
yeah, it's true.
I mean, like, I live in New York, so I can say, like, oh, no, like, I've been fine, and I've been very privileged to be able to be out at work and, you know, to have those conversations and push the envelope, but I don't know that that's... my experience might not necessarily be indicative of what's happening out there in the world for other people. So, I don't know. I think it's hard to judge from our perspectives.
I mean, just one observation on the theoretical level. Like, I don't feel like we're talking about sex any more than we were in the 70s or 60s or the teens or whatever, 200 years ago. It's just that the speed at which it's happening and the way that it keeps getting passed around by people changes. So you move from, like, a moment of, like, oh, my God, teenagers are showing up on MySpace to, oh, my God, sexual predators on MySpace to, oh, my God, 90,000 sexual predators on MySpace. We have to delete them. Like, that... there's no real kind of time to sit and cook and think about these shifts. Like, we're expected because of the media cycle and because that's moved online. Like, we're, like, making decisions about sexuality and public life a lot faster than maybe people were in the 70s. Like, it probably took a lot longer to organize a letter writing campaign to harass your business in the 70s than it would today. And so, you know, I think that the other thing that's interesting about the sex toy thing is, like, with things like Amazon, where people can just order anonymously in their own home, it's almost like a reprivatization of these things. Like, there are whole book companies and sex toy companies that wouldn't be profitable if it weren't for anonymous distribution through venues like that. So it's complicated. It's never just because we're doing more or we see more or it's happening faster that it's, you know, any more accepted.
Has that been your experience?
For me?
Just an
as a personal acceptance? I've just gotten older.
You have multiple. I mean, what you just said, you have multiple, you know.
I don't know. I mean, I think I just choose my friends and my really close friends really closely. I mean, again, like Daisha said, I'm probably like the worst person to pose that question to because of what I do by necessity, I choose to flock to people who get it. And so in that regard, what I do in being as out there as I am, for example, being out there as a sex worker and then choosing to go on OkCupid under my own name, you know, like anybody who's savvy on OkCupid could just go and Google me and find out that I'm a sex worker and decide whether or not to date me based on that. Right, so did I lose a potential relationship or something because of that? Or even in a work case scenario, like I'll use that name and when I'm applying for jobs and because it is my name now. Am I losing opportunities? Not really, because they were never opportunities to begin with. You know, if I was going to have to be closeted, that's how I look at it.
So the next thing on my list that I want to move on to is, if I have in my notes, as the tides of feminism and online community. One of the things in leading up to this conference was originally founded by Amber as the intersection of social media, feminism, and sexuality. And this year there's been some conversation about the feminism part of that and whether or not we're still truly integrating that into our conversations. So I wanted to make this a space to talk about that a little bit. In the week leading up to the conference, Amber blogged a little bit about her concerns about where feminism fits in. Does it fit in anymore to this conference and to these conversations? And Furry Girl also in the past year and change has decided that she does not identify herself as a feminist anymore. And so I wanted to kind of speak to that a little bit just because it's kind of unique to have this group of people to be able to talk about that. And from my perspective, like, I still feel and have always felt very devoted to the word feminism, and to the movements of feminisms, plural. And that's something that I hold near and dear and is very important to my identity. And it's definitely the sort of the first identity that I had as I was becoming politically and sexually aware. So that's where I'm coming from with it. And I feel like it's still very important to integrate that into conversations around sexuality. And I know Amber agrees with me, but I'm interested to hear Furry Girl, the defected feminist.
So I think Ren, Match, and I are the only non-feminists at this conference. As far, and is anyone else here not identified as a feminist?
We decided last night to identify as equalists.
One?
Yes.
All right. On one person. I used to be pretty firmly identified as a sex-positive feminist, and I would engage online with a lot of different communities here and there about trying to retake that term and trying to get more acceptance of sex workers' rights among a lot of people who are really second-wave influenced, and I just got really tired of fighting that battle because I was sick of seeing feminism used as a euphemism for awesome and used to validate, like, well, this is good because it's feminist, and, you know, if you just went through a lot of those things and switched out feminist with awesome, then, you know, that's basically what the conversation is, and I saw feminism being used all the time as this qualifier as to whether or not something was acceptable or not. If it's feminist, then it's acceptable, but if it's not feminist, then it's suspected of being misogynistic. So I made the cut of saying that I'm tired of fighting over a word that doesn't mean anything to me anymore, so I am now an ex-feminist.
Are you an awesomeness?
I'm an awesomeist. I'm a militant awesomeist.
Yeah, I'm still a feminist, and now I feel like we've tilted. I was gonna like not say anything, so it'd be like the illusion of two and two, but whatever. it's not like that. We're all friends. Yeah, I mean, my perception of feminism and the internet is that feminism online is really annoying. Actually, like most, what is thought of as feminism online is really annoying. I would like have to bore myself a hole in the head daily if I only hung out on Pandigan, Feminist, and Feministing. And like those are all fantastic blogs, but I feel like engaging with the sort of feminist discourse there is really exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I always have to defend myself and I'm having the same conversations over and over again, which was what was so fantastic about Sex 2.0, was like finally we can like kind of start on some sort of, not level playing field, but like a certain kind of assumptions around like sexuality and feminism are intermingled and interlinked, and we have to bring other lenses of analysis to politics other than gender, and that this is a place to do that. And I still feel that, and I feel like that's really important because that gets lost. And there's this polarizing that I just don't want to be a part of online, where it's like, you know, you got the feminists over here doing this, talking about sex in this certain way, and then people talking about sexuality over here feeling very disengaged from feminism. And I feel like that's just a huge problem. And I don't really know how to bring those two kinds of discourse back together. My personal strategy has been just to like forget about US-based feminism for the most part, and I've been doing a lot of international work and looking at how gender-based violence and gender-based discrimination functions outside of the United States, which is giving me a much healthier perspective on the kinds of fights we keep having. They actually feel like the fights of very privileged people who are just like taking a lot of, I don't know, like I just don't have the energy to argue with anybody about pornography ever again. I'm totally over it. I've been doing it for 16 years and I'm done, and I feel like I have the right to say I'm done. This is the job of 19-year-old women's studies students. This is the job. And you go forth and you do that, and then, you know, whatever, we'll be over here. So.
Well, I agree that a lot of the online feminist spaces can be very exhausting. I don't participate in a lot of them because I don't ever feel like I can say the right thing, and I don't think it's worth it if I have to, you know, think for 30 minutes about every word that I use. But I don't think that's feminism. I mean, I don't know. I guess I've heard a lot of people a lot of bloggers that I really respect and love their writing, love what they have to say, like Ren, for example, disidentify with that, if that's a word, with that term, because they've seen so much bullshit, you know, from people, you know, claiming whatever in the name of feminism. That doesn't, I respect that, you know, they can identify however they want, but that doesn't make sense to me. I mean, nobody's ever going to take that label from me. I don't know. For some reason, I've just never felt, I've never felt threatened by, you know, some asshole says I can't be a feminist because I don't think, you know, sex work is always exploitation. Well, whatever. You know, I don't, that doesn't, for some reason, that just doesn't, I don't feel threatened by that. I don't feel like that challenges, you know, calls into question whether or not I really am a feminist, because I am. And that's all there is to it. And Sex 2.0 is a sex-positive space, and for, in my mind, sex positivity and feminism go together. It doesn't make sense to me to have one or the, it doesn't, I don't even know how to, like, I can't even understand how they could be two separate things. So that's why, you know, regardless of how anyone identifies, which they're welcome to do whatever they want, I do think Sex 2.0 is, and, you know, is identified as a feminist space for that reason. I think I got off on a tangent.
No, you're totally cool. You're also a fantastic feminist infiltrator. Like, that's the thing that you did. Just, like, there, you have the patience to go into those spaces. And
no, I don't.
If you don't, maybe I did two and a half years ago.
You're good at fooling people to think you do.
Oh, my God. You report back from them. So.
I think exhausting is a really great term. Like, Amber and Melissa both said that. It is exhausting to spend, you know, even a few hours a week defending yourself against people who, I can't tell you how many people have told me some variant of, you are the reason that women are raped, you are the reason that children are abused, you personally, that guys go and look at my naked pictures and then beat up their wives. It's incredibly exhausting, emotionally and otherwise, to try to engage with those people. And try to engage...
How is that even feminist? I mean, isn't it my right to choose what I want to do with my body and myself? And who are these people to tell... you that that's wrong.
Well, that's the whole big debate,
you know,
and it's
like,
really exhausting.
To me, it's sort of, I think of us as like sort of like evolved feminists. The ones that behave like that are kind of ignorant. You know, they're old school, or they're the 19-year-old women's studies majors who are just like, you know, catching on to the second.
And
grade.
I was
yeah.
that 19-year-old women's studies
oh,
major.
Oh, and so
was I. I walked that road. I watched those movies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I think that some of us go through those phases, but to me, like that's not what feminism was ever meant to be.
And one of the frustrating things is, of course, I know that I'm not going to change the minds of people that feel that way, but I think a lot of people, if they're trying to look within their own communities online, if there's a feminist section of a forum or whatnot, that's what they're going to find a lot of the time are those people with the older second wave values. So I'm not trying to change their minds, but looking at younger people that might be coming on or people that are new to sex positivity and sexual politics, I've been the lone dissenting voice defending sex workers in a number of different forums, and you know, I find the value in being that dissenting voice and in trying to be like the sole sex worker telling people what sex work is about, but it's exhausting.
I just tried to go try to produce feminism in other spaces.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a lot of people gave me flack for writing for Ballywag, which is thought of as incredibly sexist. And I think the reason it's thought of as incredibly sexist is because Silicon Valley culture is incredibly sexist, and that's what the site documents. And so I thought being there as a woman and being there as a feminist was an incredibly crazy intervention.
That
and
was really, I mean, I really have to give you public props for that. I already did on my blog, but that was just,
but
I was like, I couldn't take it.
My editors had my back, and they were just, you know, that it felt like they totally got it. And my editors weren't particularly feminist. But I was able to show up every day and claim some space. And so rather than get entangled in these exhausting conversations, I just said, okay, fine, I'm not going to go defensively demonstrate feminism somewhere. I'm going to go produce a different kind of feminism somewhere else. And that's
and
the sanity.
I think also, like, this segues neatly into the next point, which is that there's been this thing that started to happen for some of us where we are trying to actively infiltrate, to use the word mostly used. And engage in other spaces outside of this, like, sex-positive sort of insular community, which, you know, is insular, but we don't all necessarily agree with each other anyway. But, so, I mean, there's a lot of those shifts that are happening in this sort of ping-pong effect of figuring out where this stuff lives. And so last summer, we had this sort of awful couple of weeks where a lot of the sex bloggers and sex writers... all sort of lost their jobs. Melissa got canned from Ballywag. I was writing a blog for the Village Voice called Naked City that got abruptly, the plug got pulled on it. Regina Lynn left her column at Wired. Tristan Termino got fired from the Village Voice after almost 10 years. Who else?
Rachel.
Yeah, well, that was a while. Rachel happened. She got fired from The Voice a couple of years ago. But
Fleshbot lost most of its
Fleshbot got chopped. And so we all sort of had this moment where it was like, okay, we're... Who's going to pay us to do what we do?
We thought we had this, like, kind of victory. Like, we had all gone,
kind of
legit.
Yeah, but we all had paid, people were paying us to hear us talk about our ship,
right,
which is pretty cool. And then they weren't paying us anymore. So, but what that sort of forced our hand is made us, some of us at least, look for more mainstreamist jobs. I mean, I made the choice to make the leap to the nonprofit world. And so, you know, it's created this, some new opportunities, but some fear for us about what the hell, what does a sex positive space look like? Is it one kind of space? Is it dispersed around other kinds of communities on the internet? Like, where does that live now? Do you have an answer for that?
Where
does it live?
My firing was, I kind of resent the fact that, like, my firing got turned into a trend story, like, just bitterly, and I don't know why I'm so resentful, partially because I got fired, but also, like, it did happen over time, and the economy was starting to slide, and some of these places were not particularly trustworthy venues, and that's
the
beast.
They were just writing our paychecks, and we were happy about
right.
That.
Right, I mean, but The Voice and Gawker, like, can you really trust these people, and knock on whatever, but, like, the you can't trust anybody who's supposedly paying you to write. That's the lesson I got at the end of the day, that you have to be dispersed and, you know, how you're getting your income. But that said, I think it played on this kind of idea that a lot of sex writers who are trying to write professionally have had to wrestle with, which is like, oh, well, we already have our sex writer. We have Dan Savage, or we have our advice columnist. And writing about sexuality in a more nuanced way, not just giving advice, but doing reporting, or not just talking about your personal life, but revealing other people's lives, that came into question. Like, where do you go do that kind of work? And my answer to doing that kind of work is to go into other more mainstream venues. Because I feel like if I brand myself as somebody who just writes about sex, I get many more limited opportunities, especially as a woman. Because the assumption is that I want to be Carrie Bradshaw. And shoes notwithstanding, I don't. So it's like, that's really what the moment of reckoning was like, well, fuck. Like, I've perceived as this, and, like, this has very limited opportunities with it. And it's not that I'm ashamed of this. This is who I am. But I'm sorry. Like, you know, I want to be writing for Wired. I want to be on NPR. And if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to identify myself with different kinds of stories and really stand by my methods as a reporter and not just as the girl who's not afraid to take her top off. That's not actually a skill as a writer at the end of the day. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's not actually have anything to do with your ability to be an ethical writer or a capable writer.
Well, I never got paid for writing, so I don't know. The whole thing, I mean, you talk about exhausting. I don't know. Listening to these kinds of conversations from my friends who lost their jobs, who were infiltrating finally and, like, starting to get that message out there little by little. And I try to go back and forth in my head, you know, people deserve to get paid for their hard work versus, you know, new media doing it for passion, not getting paid, the pros and cons of both. It absolutely wears me out. So I feel fortunate in a way that I don't make my living as a sex writer. Because, I don't know, that seems like a really tough environment.
But supposedly you're recession-proof, right?
Yeah, supposedly.
That's what the sex writers are saying,
yes.
Anyway. But porn is recession-proof.
The new sex writers that replace the two of you. Jack?
Just all the firings, do you guys feel was economically, so was there some kind of backlash? Because it seems like a lot of bloggers, sex bloggers and other people started getting more money. It's being picked up by the industry. So do you think fires are backlash or purely economic?
I don't think it's a backlash. People started writing about that, about, like, the you know, censorship of sex bloggers, whatever, I think that's bullshit. Like, I really don't think that that's what was happening last summer and fall at all.
In my case, it was the misfortune of working for a former reporter for the Financial Times. And he saw the crash coming sooner and took action. I mean, 18 other people got fired from Gawker the day that
the other thing is, yeah, exactly. Like, this isn't just endemic to sex writing. That this is sort of what's happening on the internet, where it was like, yay, we're gonna all, like, write a lot of new content all the time and, like, get paid $10 a post and, you know, whatever. So that happened for a while, and then it was like, wow, there sure is a lot of stuff that's being produced, and so there has to be scaling back of that. And the thing that I sort of got to with it was like, okay, maybe the future of creating sex culture online is not in writing blogs. Maybe it's in doing activism or linking, or not linking, but like attaching our work to bigger organizations. And that's what I've done, which is, you know, work for a nonprofit where I'm doing their online content campaigns and creation. So I am technically sort of getting paid to run a blog, but it's part of a broader sexual rights campaign. So that's starting to happen a little bit too. But I think there might just not be room for 15 sex writers to get paid. That might be part of the problem too.
And a certain kind of belief that we're all interchangeable anyway. I mean, that is still there. That, like, you know, any woman who's willing to write about sex is a certain kind of person. And I do still think that that happens. And just the kinds of comments
right.
I've heard about sex writers is...
Yeah. And, I mean, the other stupid thing that happened when we all sort of got fired is that a lot of people who didn't actually read us were like, oh, who cares? No one really wants to read about, you know, the kind of sex that these women are having anyway. And it was like, none of us are actually writing about... We're not actually getting paid to write that. We're getting paid to write sex and culture reporting, which is kind of a different thing.
Well, I think that's the expectation that a lot of people have of when they hear sex writer, because actually, I lied. I had to revise my statement. I did get paid as a sex blogger writer on Download Squad for about 2 months. Before that, like a year or so before that, I'd written for like CSS Insider and JavaScript Weblog, but then they got shut down. And then they, you know, they wanted me to come back and write, you know, about sex 2.0 type stuff. So they called me their Regina Lynn, speaking of being interchangeable. So I only wrote there for like 2 months, and I think, you know, right from the start, you know, the comments from guys were like, oh, you know, this is great, the chicks gonna write about sex. Like, you know, it's this expectation of I'm gonna write about sex and how much I love it, and oh, I love dick, and like just that I'm not gonna bring in the feminism, which I did really strongly and not apologetically, and it pissed off a lot of people, and I ended up quitting because I wrote one post called something like compartmentalize or you'll get 20 lashes, like talking about things like Google putting the little warning on people's page, like when people mark their blog as adults only, they get the same warning as if someone has reported that blog as spam, and other things like that about, you know, how we have to compartmentalize. That thing got 90 comments, and it was so much of it was so predictable. You know, either I'm ugly or I'm a slut, or like, well, which is it, you know? And how dare I say these things? And I was like, fuck it. So I couldn't, I didn't have the guts that Melissa had to stick it out.
But they want you back, by the way. The gossip.
Well,
I still gossip. They want you back.
That's too bad.
Okay, so we have about 7 minutes or so. So I wanted to open up to a little bit more discussion amongst the group. Is there anything that you guys want to specifically address or ask the audience or
the
participants?
Divide stuff, but if they get there,
okay.
Yeah.
In 7 minutes.
That's a lot of time.
I know.
It is.
You steer.
What?
You steer.
I steer. Okay. Questions, comments with our remaining minutes?
There's a ton of people. Somebody's got to have something to say.
I just wanted to chime in as a feminist blogger. I write for Feminist Inc. I'm like really interested in this, you know, conversation about obviously like claiming the term and also like feminist spaces online. And there's a lot that I hate about our own blog and like the comment section. And I was thinking about live blogging this morning, and I was like, I can't live blog a workshop about like sex worker, like internal conversation about sex workers in their practice, because I need to go start at sex worker 101, right? And like I don't have the energy to do that every time, or deal with like that sort of the level of. So I struggle with that a lot, because our blog is sort of, it's like kind of mainstream feminist blog as possible. And a lot of people who read it, you know, don't know about sex workers or have like really kind of basic ideas. But then I think about the fact that you ignore the comments because a lot of people don't ever read them. That's still a place that like reaches out to young women in a sort of first step, but still farther than what they're gonna get other places, right? Like you're still gonna get this conversation. So if I can like deal with the fact that it's annoying to have to go back every time and like lay it out for people, but that's still gonna kind of move things in a certain direction. And like, you guys don't have to do that work, like it's totally voluntary, you know, but I still feel like
you're right. Feministing is a place like where a lot of especially young women start out in terms of online feminism.
Right.
It's very valuable for them.
Right. So I don't know.
But that's an interesting observation, and maybe why we end up doing that kind of 101 work and get burnt out on it ourselves is because if the feminist spaces themselves are burnt out on it, then it's like, who's going to hold that space? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's literally a blog called Sex Work 101, mm-hmm. which Dacia has worked on and co-started?
Yeah, started.
And I mean, there's a need for that kind of discourse, but I also feel like it's just going to continue to be incendiary for people. And, you know, this idea that we could share space and doing that 101 work, maybe that's where we go with it. That would be really, really helpful to know, just as a social justice kind of intervention, that, like, the sex workers aren't always the ones who have to do that.
Right, people who don't identify with that community doing the 101 work, too, not just the sex worker, right, the sex worker 101.
But also, I mean, it's also important, like, that I think creating a situation where we feel more like you guys have our back when we get in those conversations, because, you know, we've definitely all jumped into comments on feministing and then felt like, fuck this. Like, so, you know, and part of that is feeling like maybe feministing doesn't want us there, you know, and we're not, and that's, I know that that's not true from conversations I've had with people who blog on that site, but there's still that, like, why should I put myself out there when maybe people who run the site don't even want our input on this, or, like, you're not willing to do the 101 level stuff, so who, you know, like Melissa just said, who owns that, who has to do that job? And there needs to be supportive conversation there, because otherwise it's like we're at this impasse, and
right.
That's bad.
I think for a lot of people there's, like, the difference between the content on the site and then the comments, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, most of us, we write the post and then we look at comments because we have to, but it's like this, you know, it's a really disengaged sort of, like, I want to make sure no one's calling someone a slut, because you just
right.
can't, you don't have, like, capacity, you don't get paid, right? So you don't have the capacity to, like, do that work, and then it sucks because you're kind of letting other people do the battles that
right.
in some ways we could do because we have this, like, void and this whole
yeah.
dialogue about where blogging is.
Yeah. Did you have a hand?
I was just going to say, as an explicit feminist blogger, sex blogger, this is some of the first conversation about feminism I've seen this conference, and that's really interesting to me. You know, I saw your post. It's damn disappointing, to be honest.
We're going to take it back. Don't worry.
There's a Kimberly impact.
Yeah, good.
I just want to say that I feel like I'm participating as a feminist, even if I'm not going, oh, by the way, right now I'm going to speak about feminism. And that the act of sex workers, first of all, being able to participate here in the way that we do is, I think, an act of feminism. And this mixed gender space where women are able to talk openly about sex in this gender space is an act of feminism. And I'm super feminist, but I'm also just echoing what I'm
look, Ellie.
I think it's interesting to hear you guys talking about going, like, infiltrating the mainstream, because it seems like trying to break into these venues where maybe things aren't all sex positive and have to do that 101 work, it feels very scary and frustrating at first, but then you realize, wow, I'm not just talking to much people that already agree with me. And in the last year, I started cross-posting some of my stuff to Open Salon, and there's some very smart, interesting people over there. They're not, it's not a sex-positive space necessarily. There are some that are and some that aren't. And seeing the conversations that evolve in the comments over there are just mind-blowing, because you have people coming from all different angles, and I've just had my eyes opened up to a lot of different perspectives, and I think it is really helpful to remember to speak, you know, we're all here to be this community today, but to also step outside of our community regularly, and not just talk to each other, because we mostly agree with each other, and talk to people that don't agree with you and see, and also consider their opinions, not just going into a conversation to try to win people over or convince them, mm-hmm. but to, you know, channel Peter Elbow and composition theory here and say that you play the believing game a little bit. Imagine inhabiting the ideas of another person, even if you disagree with them, and see what that can do for you. Maybe it just becomes ammo for your argument ultimately, but it might actually go somewhere, keep in mind.
Yeah. Building on that, another sort of, I guess, somewhat important
sort of mainstream space would be just the general progressive blogs, like, so not feministing, but like Daily Coast is the biggest, obviously, and then Open Lab and Talking Points Media. And I definitely don't, I barely see, unfortunately, anything on the type of stuff that is being amazingly done here. And I think it's really ripe to, because you have a lot of people on the left who maybe sort of agree or with little education could agree, but they're not educated and they misuse words and they still have some sort of bad ideas about women, but could be fixed if truly argued into submission with some great rhetoric.
That's very patriarchal.
I think there's a really a really tough balance that has to be struck there. It's like I was saying the other day, I was talking about Sex 2.0 and the fact that, you know, this is a space where men are welcome and encouraged, but there's a difference between going in somewhere and expecting to be taught versus going in and expecting that you will learn. Because one is passive and the other involves equally your active participation. And I think it's very wrong to expect women, sex workers, other marginalized communities to always be at the ready to educate anyone on demand, where that person, the privileged person in that interaction, has the capacity to do the research, educate themselves a little bit, ask questions, but not, you know, I demand that you educate me now because it's your job to do that.
Justify your existence.
Of course, which is, I mean, so when I interact in those spaces, I attempt to sort of be loud and teach with whatever capacity that I have. But I know you're right, but at the same time, a lot of these people still do have privilege, and if we don't teach them, then no one is.
It's a fundamental disconnect on the left, though. I mean, it's incredibly easy to talk about reproductive rights, but, like, leave out sexuality.
Right.
Or to, like, you know, talk about women's health, but forget about sex. Like, they have these kind of safe code words for talking about the things that we all talk about and are part of these topics, but that, like, require a lot more risk to put on the table. Like, I hear over and over again that Yearly Coast just does a crap job at incorporating queer issues and a crap job at incorporating women's rights and sexuality in a meaningful way. And, like, to be honest, I don't find it to be valuable to me to go into those spaces and sound that horn. I don't feel like I'd be a particularly effective person to sound that horn. It has to come from within that community. And so that's what I'm curious about. Like, where are our allies already inside those kinds of movements? And how can we, like, build them up so that they feel like, you know, they have credibility already. It has to be somebody who's recognized as credible. We would be perceived as outsiders. And that's unfortunate, but it's the reality.
So I think we can just stop there. I do have exactly 4 copies of my book left, and also the t-shirt that Amber is wearing that says, if you want to show it, says Sex Nerds Know How to Do It. I have a couple of those available also if you're interested. But thank you for coming and participating in this conversation. And
the song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on Magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of Unconcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.